Hello and welcome to the Spotlight Podcast. Today we're with Jonathan Harden from the Honest Actors blog. So today we're going to be turning the tables and speaking to Jonathan about his career and exactly what inspired him to become an actor.
Okay.
And he's sitting there looking a little bit nervous,
little
but it's going to be fine.
Yeah, I'm not used to being on the receiving end of this, so I'm more than a little bit frightened about what might happen.
Oh, we'll just have a chat because we're friends now anyway, aren't we?
Okay,
we've worked together quite a bit now. So what is it about Honest Actors that, why did you feel compelled to create it?
I think I discovered podcasts like many people through Serial. And I had always kind of known podcasts existed. It was a little thing popped up on iTunes, but it always seemed like a really niche thing. You know, if you were into like role playing or like, you know, board games or graphic novels, but I never thought there might be actually practical advice or other stuff on there, or just really good, well-told stories. And a Serial hit, and like thousands and thousands of other people, I started to listen to that and started to become aware of the power of the medium of sitting on a commute, the world blocked out, just listening to a story or somebody being interviewed. So I listened to Serial, then I listened to a podcast called Irishman Abroad, which is an Irish guy in London who interviews lots of expat Irish people in the entertainment industry. Like Sir Terry Wogan was one of the ones I listened to first. And you just kind of get a sense of what it is to listen to people chat honestly about something. And that kind of led on to me doing the obvious thing, was to search for actors' podcasts. And what I found was a lot of advice, which is really useful for lots of people. But I've always been one of those who likes to make his own mistakes. And so the kind of North American podcast in particular didn't appeal, because I felt like I was being sold a version of the industry that I didn't particularly want to subscribe to anyway. And what I really wanted more than anything was to hear actors talk honestly about everything outside of the industry, the kind of things that we do when we're not working to pay the bills and stay sane. And that didn't exist. And I was just in the midst of a bit of a low. I hadn't worked for quite a while. And I'd started to feel like I was the only one. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could get Dame Judi Dench to admit that she feels down between jobs and that, you know, that she has occasionally had to work in her local restaurant. Now, of course, that didn't happen. But what we did get was people like Simon Darwin in the first series, and Denise Goff and Jessica Rain and Tom Goodman Hill and loads of other people admit that, you know, in spite of what we may think looking at people, particularly at the upper end of the kind of hierarchy, that we might think they're really happy and content and that they're always busy and working, that actually there's another side of the industry. And that's kind of, that was the aspiration, and that's kind of what's come about, I hope.
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, in terms of coming from my perspective as a non-actor and working at Spotlight, I think before I came to the industry, you see someone on TV, so Tom Goodman Hill and Humans, and Denise Goff has won an award, and you think, oh, that's it. Oh, they've made it. You know, that's it. They're set. They're going to keep working. They're obviously earning loads of money. That must be great. But of course, the reality is once that job is over, it's when is the next one? It might not be for a while.
Yeah.
So you've created something much more relatable.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the thing is, like you say, with Tom, for example, one of the things that always sticks out in my head from all of the episodes is Tom saying that he likes, well, occasionally he doesn't like to, but occasionally he finds himself staring at the wall. And I got to that point where I think a lot of actors, and including me, have got into the habit of telling the world whenever we're working, but telling nobody whenever we're not, with a consequence that we all present outwardly this, this kind of fiction that we're all working 365 days a year, and if we're not working, we're on holiday in the Canaries or we're in New York visiting a friend.
No.
Well, funnily enough, no, but the weird thing is part of what it all came out of was people, I had a few things on telly while I wasn't working. And obviously then people would bump into me and they'd say, oh, you're doing so well. And the truth was that I was working on a building site and in a bar and hosting pub quizzes. And I very rarely put those people right. And I kind of think the bigger aim with the podcast and with the blog was to start at least moving towards a situation in which actors, between ourselves, obviously there's still a necessity to, you know, to present some kind of of public face of the fact that we're working and all the rest of it. But between ourselves, I think there's no harm to be done in admitting when we are and when we aren't working, and that we'll all be the better for that.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose to be an actor? What inspired you to start?
This is one of those questions I ask people and never thought I might have to answer, or go, I have no answer prepared. I could go back to being 3 or 4 years of age and dressing up as old men and smoking a pipe without actually having tobacco in it. I hasten to add, in case somebody calls around to my mother's house from social services in retrospect. But I could go back to that. I could go back to being at school. I was at a very academic school, which thankfully did place some value on the creative arts. But in saying that, it still fell below things like science and history and languages and all that, with the consequence that I didn't study any of these things beyond third year, didn't do GCSE drama or A-level drama, and rather was kind of on a course to be something else, something like a barrister or whatever. And various things, including doing work experience in a solicitor's office, made me realise I never wanted to be in the legal profession. And arriving at university to study English and French, ultimately, and realising within a week of doing that it wasn't really for me, and being lucky enough that the university I was at had just started a drama degree course that didn't require you to apply via UCAS. They were just looking for a bunch of no-hopers to test the course out on in the first year. So I found myself with 32 people who didn't apply to do drama on a drama degree. And if I'd went to any other university in any other year, that wouldn't have been the case. So I kind of went on that path and started to direct a bit and produce a bit, and always had this thing that I wanted to be an actor, but because everyone else in the year who was an actor didn't want to produce or take responsibility for projects, I became the person that did, and let it all slide until I kind of got married and was nearly 30 and was working full time as an academic, as a lecturer in drama at Queen's University in Belfast, and was on honeymoon and said to my wife, who is an actor, I kind of want to go back and give acting a go. So that's like 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I handed in my notice to my job at Queen's, and we moved to London about a month later with 2 suitcases and about £3,000 in the bank and no agent, and took it from there. So like, why I did it, I still can't quite say. It's not like a lot of the people I interview, it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a bit like one of those kind of actors who I'm always looking around for the next thing, be it an acting project or something else to kind of get my hands into, like, you know, in terms of the podcast is just one example. Mm. But I just like having new things to do and take an interest in. And sometimes that's a new acting job, and other times it's like, I wonder, can I make a documentary? Would that work? So I've always just had that kind of creativity. But the acting, I think, was one of those things. And I love it. But the older I get, the more I'm aware of the fact that I also love doing loads of other things.
Yeah. As long as it's industry related and you keep creating, then you're happy, as long as you keep busy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably a bad person for that question, because I'm the kind of person that if I, you know, I see a gap on the wall and think, do you know what would look nice? There is a nice shelf with some hooks underneath it, and I go and make a shelf and buy some hooks and put it up. That to me is being creative. Like, that keeps me sane. So a lot of the time when I'm not working, it could be making a podcast at the minute, it's trying to get a short film off the ground. But equally, it could be, you know, putting a new floor down, mm-hmm. or, you know, making something. Like, that's just, I suppose it's, I don't know, that somebody called it in the podcast like a magpie kind of mentality. I think mm-hmm. it was Joe McGann who described himself as a magpie. And I have a bit of that. Like, I like to write a bit, and I like to do this and do that and everything else, which I think is actually long term been pretty good for my own mental state, because otherwise I think I would have felt the gaps in my acting work a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I guess that's something you're kind of born with, isn't it, in a way? Because if I could have an inch of that, that'd be great. If I could be more proactive in getting, like, photos framed and things. Because otherwise Netflix is far too tempting.
Yeah.
And Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is on there. Yeah. And there's 2 whole series. And then there's so much more to go. Yeah. And I find myself just thinking, oh, I just don't want to do those little household chores when, you know, there is stuff that could be done to the house, but you think, oh, I just don't really want to. So it's something you've always had then.
Yeah, it's funny, like, about 2 weeks ago, I get a lot of people will say to me, like friends, he'll go, you never stop. But inwardly, I think I'm really lazy. So I have this opinion of myself that I'm really lazy. I don't know where I get it from, because I think sometimes if I sit back, I go, actually, you've been quite busy. But like about 2 weeks ago, for example, I sat most of the day at my laptop and got about 4 emails sent. And the end of the day, I felt really crappy about it all. Mm-hmm. And then realised it's because it was dark outside and I hadn't left the house. And went out and ordered some daylight light bulbs and stuck them up in the house. And actually, since then, things have been much better. So I'm kind of like everyone else, you get those days where you can do nothing. Mm-hmm. But I've got much better at sitting outside of it and asking, like, why am I feeling like this? Mm-hmm. And is it because, you know, I'm getting angry at the world, or is it because there's actually I need to open some blinds, yeah, or I need to get out and go for a walk? Or so I've got much better at actually, you know, even when I do just sit I want to watch like New Girl or like something just popcorny on Netflix, that's fine, because that's part of a bigger picture which includes me trying to make other things happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's like anything else, it's, you know, everything in small doses. And there are times when I can't wait to sit down in my pajamas and watch Netflix. And I'm at one of those moments right now where I'm just like, please let it be next Tuesday so that I can, because you know when you've got things booked in, and that's great. But yeah, I think anything, if I did anything for too long, and that includes, I could never do like a show for a year. I think that would kill me. Yeah. I just don't have one of those brains that can focus for a long time.
Yeah. So in terms of mental health and touching on that then, because you just said you went out and got some daylight light bulbs. Just kind of the little things that can also help, not sort of obviously trying to diminish the experiences of more serious conditions, but just to keep on top of working. And when you do get, just in terms of the getting a little bit down, I guess, in terms of people not working so much, would you find it sort of making sure you do get out, go to the gym, get an SAD lamp, and those little things can help you just start the day quite stronger?
I found quite quickly that left to my own devices, I would settle into a routine whereby I would get up out of bed, you know, at 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, whatever. But I would get up with my dressing gown, sit at the kitchen table with a mug of coffee, maybe some orange juice, maybe a newspaper, imagine in my head that I was Robert De Niro and that I didn't have to do anything today apart from read some scripts. But actually, I had to pay bills, which is one of the best things, I think, when I first arrived in London, was having a job. Like, as I think, and I've said this in the podcast loads, it's not just actors that get down when they're not working. Anybody who's not working gets down. It's part of, you know, we all feel like we want to have something, a reason to get up, whatever that might be. So I think giving yourself a reason to get up, whether it be going out and having a job which involves some kind of social interaction, ideally with people who aren't actors, in a restaurant or a bar or wherever it is you work. And if you don't have to do that, or you don't have to do that every day, things like the gym, like I started only going to the gym 4 or 5 years ago, and it totally changed my attitude. Like, it gave me a reason to get up. I felt purposeful when I went into the auditions. I felt like I looked as good as I could look in physically. I didn't feel like I was hiding anything or like I was. And that's not to say that, you know, everybody needs to be like ripped or buff. And it's certainly not to say that that's what I was. But it's kind of like it's a bit of confidence thing. And the more confidence you can walk into a room with, the better. And if that just means feeling healthy and feeling like, you know, when you come to the top of the stairs at Spotlight, that you're not out of breath. Like, maybe that's something to aspire towards. And I think more recently for me, like, we got a dog, which was amazing because it gave us a focus of attention beyond, outside of ourselves, which I think sometimes actors are really bad at. I think we all get a little bit obsessed with ourselves and our own stories and our own progression. And we become bored. Like, you speak to so many actors and the only thing they want to talk about is acting, or even worse, that they're not acting and how bad it is and how lucky everyone else is and how terrible their agent is and how they didn't get seen for X, Y, and Z, and did you get seen for X, Y, and Z, and how did you get in for that, and so on and so forth. And for me recently, the big thing has been having a focus of attention outside of ourselves, i.e. the dog, bizarrely. And then, like I say, silly things, like just, not silly, but sitting outside sometimes of your own little bubble and evaluating why you feel the way you do. So with me, like the other week, it was, oh right, okay, it's winter, I forget sometimes that winter affects me. So I went out and bought probably too many daylight light bulbs, and the flat now looks like it's permanently in summertime. But that's been great, and getting vitamin supplements or whatever. But you know, just being proactive, mm-hmm. I think is the key. So whatever form that takes, whether it's physical exercise or proactively getting up to read, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter, as long as it's something that momentarily takes you outside of, oh my God, yeah. I'm not working.
Yeah.
Where is my next audition coming
yeah.
from?
And I think it does make you more sort of ready and flexible for auditions as well, because you don't know what scripts are going to come in. At least if you're healthy and you're fit and you can do whatever is sort of demanded of you, you're in much better shape,
yeah.
as well as getting up the stairs at Spotlight, which I do every day. I'm not sure I could do it without the gym, to be honest.
I remember coming off a train. I'd been away for a couple of days and I'd got a part in a short film and I met the director directly off the train, and I'd been kind of like eating very well and drinking very well with my wife on a trip away for 4 days. And came back to start filming like 4 days later for something I'd just been offered, which involved me, and this is the one time in my career, being 100% naked in a full length shot and thinking, I wish I hadn't just been to Paris and eaten so much food.
Mm-hmm.
And then since then, this has gone back a bit, like you can do, you know, a certain amount in 3 or 4 days, but you can't change your physical body shape.
Mm.
But since then, I've said to so many friends, like, the thing is to be ready when the call comes,
mm-hmm.
rather than have the call come, panic and think, it's Tuesday, I've got an audition on Thursday, I better look in shape on Thursday.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
No.
So there's not, aside from the whole mental health thing, there's just, it's that thing of being ready for the call when mm-hmm. it comes. You don't have to sit and wait by the phone for the call,
yeah.
but know that whenever that call comes, you can confidently go on Thursday, I can walk into a room and be the best version of myself, whatever that might be.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's quite hard to stay on top of that. So it's quite a learning curve to know.
Yeah, you have to have at least, I don't know about other people, like I said at the start from the podcast thing, I'm not great with taking advice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm slightly better at learning from my own mistakes. I wish I was brilliant at learning from my own mistakes, because quite often I have to make them 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often I'll forget the lessons I've learned until I have to learn them again. But yeah, I think a part of it is that learning curve of, oh, right, that felt awful. And you walk down the stairs in Spotlight or wherever you are and you think, that was awful because I wasn't ready. Mm. And whatever that is, learning lines, anything, whatever, I need to learn those lessons, I think, before I'll actually change.
So talking of learning lessons,
mm-hmm.
your first acting job, what was that and how do you think you've grown
God.
Since then?
My first professional, the first thing I ever got paid to do was a commercial in Northern Ireland that I got paid £400 check on the day, and I know the woman now that wrote the check. She's a producer in Belfast and she was eventually my agent. She started an agency for the election in 2001. There was a local election in 2001 and I was a somebody standing talking to camera, and it was immensely exciting and I felt like I was a rock star, like, because I'd been given a costume and I was standing up against a graffiti wall and it all just felt like, if I'm totally honest, and I know a lot of people on the podcast, I've asked this question and they've mm-hmm. said, no, it didn't feel, I felt like that was my big break.
Yeah.
I felt like that £400 and that, I was a student at the time, so 400 quid was like $2,000.
Yeah.
I felt like that was my big break. I felt like, and it wasn't just limited to in my head, it wasn't limited to commercials. I didn't mm-hmm. think that I'll get another commercial. I thought, I'll start to get theatre work now. Like,
like
you have this, I had this silly version of, like, a really naive version of the industry mm-hmm. in my head that now people will see me on telly and that'll be it.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, that's 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah, it's not how it happens.
And that's not how it happens.
No.
And I'll admit that several times since I've felt like, oh, this is it now. Things will be easier. That'll open doors. I'll not have to audition for one line anymore or whatever. And it never is the case. But in terms of how I think I've developed since that, I don't know. Sometimes I think I get better. Sometimes I think I get worse.
Mm-hmm.
I was at home at the weekend and I met a guy who's 17 and he's just done his first short film, acting in it, and he wants to be an actor and he's just signed with an agent. And I was chatting to him because his dad's a friend. And his dad said, oh, you should speak to Jonathan for advice, which I always hate as an introduction. It's a horrible introduction. It's like, it's hard enough to talk to a teenager already without mm-hmm. without putting that pressure on both of us. But he was much cooler than I am and he was chatting away and he said, like, you know, what's your advice? Or, like, you know, and I said, do you, when you watch the short film that you've just done, do you think you're good?
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. And I was like, well, hold on to that. Because I've always felt like if you watch yourself, as Tom Goodman Hill says, he's very, very skeptical or cautious around overconfident actors.
Mm-hmm.
Be confident by all means, but know the things that you do badly as well as the things that you do well. Don't beat yourself up for them, over them. But I think as you get to know more, I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Mm-hmm.
The more you know about something, the better equipped you are to pick the holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it stands to reason that the more you act or the better you get at acting, that means you should be in a way better at criticising and therefore better at picking out the things that you do brilliantly but also the things you do badly. And I've always been the kind of person who can pick out, can say, oh yeah, I think I like that thing I did, but more than that I'll say that Jonathan was absolutely terrible, never do it again. And with the consequence now, I don't watch myself when I do things. Like if it's on telly, I'll not watch it. I might watch it with one eye, but with one eye on Twitter, looking to see if somebody says something absolutely hilarious about my costume or my hair or something like that. But yeah, I think the big thing for me is being hold on to the sense that it's a journey. You're never going to be there.
Yeah.
If you look at yourself and think you're brilliant, then you're probably a psychopath.
Yeah. That's the interesting thing about Dunning-Kruger is the people who think they're amazing when actually they're one of the lowest marked people in the class, for example.
Yeah.
They rate themselves as being probably the top of the class.
Yeah.
So and it's if you brilliant. Start
you should
off
look it up. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Heard it on a podcast.
Yeah. I think I did as well.
Yeah.
I think I might have as
probably
well.
Probably This American Life.
Yeah.
I listened
was.
To a lot of that and TED Radio Hour. Oh.
Yeah. So Dunning-Kruger is I've started to live my life with the realisation that that exists.
It's a real thing, yeah.
That's a real thing. And actually, it was the other day I'd done some graphic design for something I was working on myself, a project. And I was, for weeks, I've been going, this is actually really good graphic design. And then I remembered Dunning-Kruger and looked at it again and tried really hard to see the flaws and then started to see them and thought, you absolute idiot, you promised you wouldn't be one of those people. But, you know, how do you... how do you evaluate something that you have no skill in? So that's the thing I always try to remember is from that. And actually the bizarre thing is in that 2001 advert, I thought I was brilliant in it. For all it was two lines to camera saying, you know, don't forget your polling card or something. But I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, I think that's the danger. And I think that's something you know to avoid.
As soon as you've got a name for it, you go, oh, I know someone like that. And it's probably been me at some point as well. You're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think we all have. It's a blind spot. That's the thing. By definition, we all have those things that we think we're brilliant at. And we're probably not. But that's no reason to give up.
You know,
it's and in many ways, it's a motivation to keep going and get better.
That's so inspirational. Who's your inspiration? Who's the most inspirational person you've met, if you are allowed to name names?
Ooh.
There's someone that you've interviewed and you've just gone, wow, I want to follow that path.
I love when I meet an actor that isn't nuts. And by that I mean, there was a long time when I was convinced you couldn't be an actor, have a stable home life, not be addicted to some kind of substance, and be a nice person. I was convinced that wasn't possible because a lot of the jobs that I'd done when I started to get higher profile jobs and, you know, a lot of the lead actors, actresses, you'd find a significant proportion of them, certainly I would think, and they probably thought of me, it's fair to say, were not jobs. Like you'd think, how do they get away with being such a total idiot on set or, with other people? So the first time I met a really nice, I was like, that guy's lovely. I was working with an actor on a film and he's quite high profile and I thought he's going to be difficult. And the very first day he was really quiet and then the second day was slightly warmer and by the third day he was like being lovely. And it turns out he was the actor I'd been looking for because I'd actually got to the point with my wife where I'd said, if this is the price of being an actor, if the price is, you know, having an unhappy marriage and being addicted to something and having really low self-esteem mixed with really high self-esteem, then I'm out. I'm not willing to pay that for anything. And the more of those actors I've met over the years, the more assured I've become that it is possible. But I think sometimes you can get into that, the sense that, everybody's nuts. Everybody in this mm-hmm. industry's nuts. And obviously that's for reasons that, you know, we have these amazing highs and ridiculous lows, and that we don't get paid very well for what we do, and we've all got to do other jobs, and there's, you know, lots of reasons why actors might be, you know, on that scale of let's say imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I was really lucky that one of the people that who I will mention, who I think is an outstanding actor, and also gave me a great sense that, you know, that you could be a balanced, nice person and mm-hmm. be an actor, a guy called Paul Higgins,
yeah,
who is a Scottish actor I worked with about 3 or 4 years ago. And A, he's an amazing actor, but B, he's also the first person on set to warm up
mm-hmm.
unapologetically doing yoga and sit-ups and press-ups and leading the company in a vocal warm-up, and just being one of those people who takes responsibility for himself but mm-hmm. also for other people, like in a way that isn't in any way invasive or obtrusive or arrogant, and then delivers with the performance as well. So people like Paul that I've been lucky to work with are hugely inspiring. Mm-hmm. And also like when you get to work with a director who values actors, like Howard Davies, who passed away really recently, who was the first director to give me a paid theatre job. Like, I'd done a fair amount of filming, but I'd done a fair amount of French theatre, but no one had ever hired me to stand on a theatre mm-hmm. stage and act until Howard hired me for a job at the National Theatre. And I didn't quite know how I'd got there, but was delighted to be there. And when you work with someone like that who has impeccable taste and who kind of teaches you how to act, and whenever you suggest something, wants to see it, and then finds a way to tell you that actually your instinct in this occasion stinks,
mm-hmm.
but that next time it might not, and then the next time you have an idea, it's, you know, and it's great, he's totally on board,
yeah.
but there's a great sense of you trust him to help you through a process mm-hmm. that will ultimately make you look as good as you can within the context of a bigger story.
Yeah.
And those people, I think, they're not few and far between, but they're to be cherished. And mm-hmm. when people like Howard, I think, pass, they do leave huge gaps. And for me, the experience of working with people like that as an untrained actor, those are the things I crave and look forward to, because I want to learn. And I think those experiences, I imagine, are as close to training as I'll ever get.
Yeah. And directors are there to bring the best out of you and to get the best performance. So
yeah,
that's so nice.
And they want you to be brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes when people get notes, you can see them die inside.
Mm.
And I think momentarily we can all forget that casting directors want us to be brilliant.
Yeah,
when they bring us into a room, they want you to be amazing.
Yeah.
Directors want us to be brilliant, because by turn, they will look better
yeah.
if all of their cast.
Yeah.
It's very rare you get an ensemble of 12 actors where you don't watch it and think it's a pity that one or two, you know, slightly weaker or didn't quite do what you thought they might. But like, you know, those directors who can get an ensemble to pull together and work for the greater good and be solid as an ensemble are few and far between, actually. Yeah, I'm going to think about it. So so that's the thing I think we have to remember as well, is just everybody wants us to be brilliant. Nobody wants us to fail. Nobody wants us to trip up. So I think you just have to realise that there's a lot of goodwill in the room when you walk in spite of the fact it may feel otherwise.
Yeah, we say that a lot in terms of casting directors as well. They've brought you in for a reason, because they think that you're going to be suitable for the role and you're there to just solve their problem.
Yeah.
And they want you to do well. And we say it all the time, but that's exactly what they want. And directors want you to do the best you can. So if they give you notes, they are experienced and they're just there to help you. And they're there to support your performance. As Lewis said, we interviewed Lewis, who directs Humans recently. And he was saying, you know, I just want the best for everyone. So to support your performance, really. And it's interesting, because a lot of actors have said or tweeted us and said, you know, I haven't really thought about it that way before. Because I can imagine it from the other side, is it is just really daunting. And you usually just look at these people, it's like, you're going to hire me and you're going to keep me employed. And if I don't do very well, then you're not going to be happy. But it's not, it's all, everyone's working together. It's a collaboration rather than a hierarchy, as it were.
And Lewis is one of those great people as well. Lucky enough to work with as well, who is, when you arrive to work for Lewis, takes the time to say hello and tell you why you're there mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. And I think those things, like if I was to be saying anything to casting directors or to directors, it's that those first few minutes are so important. Like when you walk into a room, being reminded that everyone's behind you is mm-hmm. very important, because sometimes it's easy to forget that, particularly in a waiting room where anxiousness is almost is catching. Like, you can almost see it move from one person to the next. It's like, it just transfers.
Yeah.
So there's a collective anxiety in the waiting room. Then you walk in, it's quite good if people remind you that actually we're all here and, you know, we like this, or, you know, it's great, you know, that you're back in or whatever. But I think equally when you arrive on a job, so I remember doing a massive job, which I again thought was a massive break, turned out not to be. And I had like 3 months work on this TV series, which was supposedly 12, it was 12 parts, it was supposedly going to be massive, and then the States and blah, blah, blah. And I had a huge budget. And the first day I had to get shot at point blank range in a crowd scene. It was my character's last scene of 3 episodes. And I did the whole thing, about 200 extras. Squib went off, I died. I went home, couldn't have told you where the director was. Like, he never came forward.
Wow.
There was like a video city, a video kind of like, you know, awning, loads of monitors and stuff, like 500 yards away. And I could kind of trying to see where he was, and I couldn't quite remember which one he was from the audition. And like 3 days in, he came over and said, "Oh, Jonathan, it's nice to have you." And you think, it's too late.
Yeah.
Like, I've been kind of trying to find a way through something, and your confidence slowly goes.
Yeah.
It's very, like, it's such a fragile thing.
Yeah.
And that kind of, for me, is really difficult, because I always think, and I'm just about to direct for the first time on screen, and I hope that I'm going to be one of those directors that puts my arm around an actor when they arrive on set, tells them how delighted I am that they're the person that has chosen to work with me, and kind of, you know, make them feel at home. And like, Lewis is one of those people who does that.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely does that. I was one day of a thing with Lewis and felt like I was he was lucky to have me, was the impression that, and that's the way you want to feel. It's silly and it's kind of childish to need that. But I think you definitely do. I definitely do.
Yeah. It's important to build those relationships as well.
Yeah. Yeah. He probably doesn't remember who I am. I'd be interested.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
So what's next for Honest Actors?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The next for Honest Actors is I'm currently watching and rewatching the very first Honest Actors Emerging Actors Roundtable in association with Spotlight. I should have come up with a more catchy title, I know. But we filmed that, I think, was it 3 or 4 weeks ago? And the hope is that I imagine we'll be ready before Christmas. One would certainly hope so. But that's kind of where we're going next. I think the podcast series 2, we're about episode 7 or 8 now, and that will continue, I think, until like episode 13, and then I'll have to see where I am in terms of sponsorship and if people are still listening, because that's the other thing, is that these things can be really, really big for a while, and then actually people go, oh, well, you know what, I've heard enough conversations of actors talking to other actors honestly about not working. Now I want to hear actors telling me how the hell to get jobs. So, you know, that could go either way. And then the blog as well, which I just kind of am in the midst of a decision process over, like, how can I keep that going? Without sponsorship, B, but just also the other things I'm doing. So I'm talking to a couple of the regular bloggers about taking that over and me giving it over, which again, as I get older, I'm getting much better at. I used to be a control freak, and it's like, yep, you can have that. I don't have to worry about that anymore. But yeah, so the big thing, the big new thing is roundtable discussions.
And that was quite exciting.
Yeah,
a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it was kind of cool, because I'd originally thought, I put it out that I was going to do it, and had a chat with you guys, and was delighted that you were able to actually help me film it, because otherwise it would have been just audio.
Shot in the new Spotlight Studios, which look great, I have to say.
Yep, look fantastic. I felt like I let the Spotlight Studios down, because I'm wearing a hoodie and some jeans, and the whole thing was for it to look relaxed, but actually on retrospect I think it may have made it look too relaxed. I think I looked like I'd just rolled out of bed, but I'll let other people decide.
It was one of those days though. It was raining a lot, I think. I was in jogging bottoms and a jumper. It wasn't a good
day. Well, you weren't on camera though. I misjudged
it. Camera,
you
no.
learn you learn. But so it was kind of exciting, because I'd had this long process of applications, and we had like a couple of hundred people who wanted to be involved, some of whom weren't eligible because they hadn't read the terms and conditions, as sometimes happens. But we had about 120 people who were fully eligible and had applied, and we had to whittle that down. So I had Skype chats over one of the busiest weeks of my life I had to fit in like 25 Skype chats. And out of that, I was supposed to pick 6 actors. Mm-hmm. Picked 7 because even to get it to 7 was virtually impossible, because I got to about 12 and I could equally have had any of them. And then when I actually chatted to them, the 7 I picked are brilliant and very different people with very different stories to tell and very different routes into the industry and hopes for what will happen after they graduate. So it's a diverse group in every possible sense. The question is, will anybody else find it interesting? And that's what's really interesting to me as well, is that it's not the big, glossy Hollywood roundtable. It's not a load of actors that you and I know, and they're not slapping each other in the back in the lead up to some kind of award ceremony, talking about the role that led to their nomination. They're not actors who are you know, referring to the time they worked with Clint Eastwood. Oh, you've worked with Clint, I've worked with Clint. It's not that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly, you know what I mean? And that's lovely, and I'm sure lots of people enjoy those, and I know I love those, and I love the kind of, you know, the actor studio one-on-ones. It's all great. But it occurred to me that the kind of honest actors way into it would be who doesn't get to talk about the industry, who are the voices that don't get heard, and also there's still equal value in hearing a bunch of actors who are between the ages of 22 and 38, I think, or of 22 and 41 is the age range, who have been doing it, you know, all for less than 3 years professionally, apart from one who worked before she trained for like 10 years. And I think not just for people who want to get into the industry, but for people like me who've been in it for 10 years or more, it's a really good checkpoint to see where we are as an industry now in 2016-17, how people are getting into the industry, what their concerns are, how that's changing and shifting over time, how the industry has changed since all of us came into it, either by training or by other routes. So I'm hoping people will find it interesting for all those reasons. And it was a huge learning curve for me, because I've obviously facilitated group chats when I was teaching, but that's very different to doing it, knowing that it's going to be scrutinised. Because in a way, when I was teaching, like, it's as long as everybody gets to speak and they all find out something about the play we're discussing, that's job done. But actually in this case, it was really kind of, wasn't like terrifyingly difficult, but I was nervous about it. And actually then trying to shepherd the conversation in some way that everybody got to speak, but that we didn't just get into the kind of circular actor chat traps, like the woe is me, that everything's going to be really difficult, that I'm never going to get a job, all those things. And actually, the group are really positive anyway. But that's the kind of, I think, the pull with the Honest Actors chats is you're always afraid that given the opportunity, we'll all start to complain about how terrible everything is. And I think that's whenever everybody will switch off. So I think we've done that, and I'm kind of excited to see what other people think.
Yeah, I'm really keen to see it as soon as we all get a chance to do some editing on it.
Yeah.
It should be with you this side of Christmas, we all hope.
Yeah, an early Christmas present,
the first pilot of the UK Actors Roundtable from Honest Actors and Spotlight.
Yeah.
It was really good. I really enjoyed it. And also, if you are sort of feeling any sort of difficulty at the moment, if you are struggling with anything, do know that sort of Spotlight is here to help you. And we do have sort of careers advice sessions, which can be via Skype or phone call as well. They're not always just, I know the London one-to-ones are quite hard to book onto, but we do have Liverpool ones as well. So if you're based in Liverpool, if you just want to do a Skype or a phone call, if you're struggling right now, if you need some direction, we are here to help you, and that is free, is included. So if you're a Spotlight member, you can get in touch with us. And we've got our next open house in April. So that's going to be, we're not sure where it's going to be yet. It might be in London, it might be somewhere else. But we're going to have lots of sessions like we always do. We do them biannually. So you get to meet casting directors, you get to do workshops, you get to do Q&As. It's all about learning and keeping on top of what it is that you need to keep fresh, ready for the industry. So, yeah, lovely to have you with us today, Jonathan. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry that I rambled so
much. No, you didn't at all.
I'm not used to people giving me a microphone and a chance to speak. You'll never do it again. You've learned your lesson, I hope.
We've not talked in front of microphones before, have we? Everything changes. Suddenly it becomes very formal and we ask very formal questions. It was lovely to have you. Thank you again. And thank you for listening to the Spotlight podcast. If you like today's podcast, do follow us on Twitter at Spotlight UK and like us on Facebook as well. We're also on YouTube, and there's a wealth of advice there from all sorts of casting directors, actors, producers and directors. Everything you need to know, from showreels to how to nail an audition.